The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman on News Talk
with Kia.
And joining us in studio this week to place his reads on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf is former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. You're very welcome to the show.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
Thank you for doing this. And before we get into, I suppose, the books, I imagine, or perhaps I'm wrong, do you have more time for reading these days than you would have at one point in the past?
I do. So I used to read books maybe at Christmas time or maybe on summer holidays, but during the normal course of the year, I just didn't have time. I might be reading my memos and briefings and speeches for the next day till like 1 or 2 a.m. And the last thing I wanted to do then was start reading a book. I could never understand how Pascal Donoghue always managed to read a book, by the way. It just wasn't part of my habit, but now it actually is. So I'm kind of slowly getting through, books that I've wanted to read for years or I've heard people talking about and just kind of nodded and pretended to know what they're talking about. And now I'm actually reading those books now.
It's good to admit that. I think we've all done that. But I guess that must mean that the pace of life is a little slower. And I mean, you look very well. I imagine it's suiting you.
Look, I'm still busy. I think it's in my nature as a person to be busy. So,
You've chosen more than one very busy career in the past.
Yeah. So from medicine, which was really busy, to politics, which was kind of all consuming. So it's definitely at a slower pace. I think even when I'm like 85 years old, I'm going to be busy. It's just probably who I am.
I think you're very lucky if you're someone who can be very busy at 85 years old. If you have that kind of career or you have that kind of opportunity where you get to do things you still enjoy and want to.
Health and life permitting.
I think so. Let's kick off with your favourite book.
Yeah, so like to be honest, I don't have an absolute favourite book.
We often say to people their favourite book and they go, well, if you had to ask me next week or last week, it might not have been the same, but one of your favourite
books. So in a different studio, I've said Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, but I'm not going to do that again, but I do love it. Read it when I was a student, a medic student, doing a summer placement in India, and it's all about kids with these powers. It's really interesting. Thought about Maya Angelou's I Know Why Caged Birds Sing, which I really love. But the one I'm going to pick for today, and I do really love it, read it years ago, is Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose, which people may have read, but if they haven't, they might know from a film adaptation.
A film adaptation with Christian Slater.
Christian Slater and Sean Connery, which was back in the 80s.
I have to say, that film gave me one of the most excruciating moments of my life in the 80s because you will remember what the 80s were like in Ireland. They were a little bit repressed. And that film came on the TV. And at the time it came on the TV, I was sitting in between my mum, who was a reasonably religious woman, and my then boyfriend. And there's a particularly graphic sex scene with Christian Slater in a barn. And
it's not that graphic. Maybe it was by those standards.
When I was about 17 and my mother was
and of course, he's a novice monk, which had a particular
exactly.
And consensual scene, by the way, just
my religious mom. But I remember just thinking, please, God, make it end, make it end. We all three of us cringed our way through it, but it was a great film and it is a great book. Tell our listeners a little bit about it.
Yeah, so on the face of it, it's murder mystery. There's a series of murders that happen in a monastery, and William de Baskervilles, who is a monk, a priest, a philosopher, and a bit of a Sherlock Holmes type detective, is called in to investigate them. And his assistant, his novice, is Adzo, and it's actually him narrating the story, telling the book, it's telling you what happens in later life. So it's very much seen through his eyes. But it's a real kind of tale of intrigue. I don't want to give too much of it away.
No,
to read it.
I know
it is all about who is killing who and why.
And it's very atmospheric.
There's medieval theology. There's church politics. There's faith versus reason. There's also this whole theme, which I love, around whether you preserve knowledge or suppress it. And of course, again, without giving away the plot too much, one of the reasons why, in fact, the main reason why people are killed is because once they're allowed to read certain books and acquire certain knowledge, well, then they can't be allowed to survive because they might disseminate that knowledge. And I think in many ways,
gatekeeping.
That's quite a modern theme at the moment, when people are back to banning books and burning books and deciding what knowledge people are allowed to have. And
it's kind of always ever been thus, isn't it?
It has, yeah. But you know, it did feel like there for a couple of decades that people were allowed to read what books they wanted to and have knowledge. And even if that made people uncomfortable, challenge them. And we're getting back, I hope we're not, but we're getting back into a period now of a higher degree of censorship, and you probably do need that at the extremes, but not in the round. But if you take the whole thing, it's history, it's politics, it's murder, it is intrigue. So
I do love a historical novel. I don't know why in particular. I think I like being transported to another time and place, because I think
that escapism sparks
the imagination even more. And it is a really good book. And actually, I'm just thinking, when you said it wasn't a graphic scene, I probably saw that when I was 16 or 17. I definitely thought it was graphic. I wonder if I rewatched it now, would it be water off a duck's back?
Well, there's another scene where
teenage Kira freaked out, flagellates
himself, which I thought it would be a little bit more graphic, but
my mother probably had less of a problem with that.
Or maybe they cut that out on RTE at the time, you know.
And it would have been on RTE.
Knowledge you can't have.
And on RTE as well. Tell us what you read last.
Yeah, so just finished it. Really great book. It's called Shattered Lands by Sam Dalrymple. So for your listeners who are interested in history, they might have listened to Empire. It's a podcast, a little bit like The Rest of History, but different. Anita Anand and William Dalrymple do that podcast, and it's all about history, and I really like it. But somebody who works on it with them is William's son Sandra Impel, and he's written this book about the five partitions of India. And I think for those of us interested in history, you'll immediately think of the partition of India when the British left between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. But the lesser known aspect of history is that there really were five partitions. Burma was separated from India, and then the Gulf states, places like Kuwait, Dubai, Aden, Oman, were actually part of the British Raj. They were part of the Indian Empire, even used the rupee, and were very much part of that trading system. And a decision was taken to separate them. We'd be in a very different world today if those places were part of India or part of Pakistan. Just think of the conflict that's going on now, if that was dragging India into it, for example, nuclear-armed states. And then, of course, there was the princely states, because much of India was run by princes who had accepted British rule but still ran their own affairs. Then there was the partition of Pakistan, and then there was Bangladesh. So it's a great piece of history, and it contains a lot of things that have been forgotten by history. Like, one thing I didn't know until recently is that Hyderabad, which was a princely kingdom in the south of India, the Nizam, who was the king of that state, was, I think, the richest person or second richest person in the world at the time. He was a Muslim leader, so he'd taken over leadership from the Sultan in Istanbul after the Ottoman Empire fell. And there was a real potential parallel history that might have been different. But, you know, he eventually refused to accede to India, and they sent the troops in, and that was the end of him. So it kind of teaches us that nothing in history is inevitable, and that change can be sudden. And also, even one thing for me, it made me reassess how we see historical figures like Gandhi, for example. And Gandhi has kind of been deified through the almost a Jesus type figure. The film of Ben Kingsley, that a lot of people would know about him. And of course, he was a great liberator, a great human rights activist.
He was not without his flaws.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm kind of getting to. So, you know, but he was somebody who preached nonviolence and showed that hundreds of millions of people can gain their freedom through nonviolence. But also, he kind of stirred up Hindu nationalism and sectarianism. And you kind of wonder if partition have been avoided? Could a lot of the refugee crises and turmoil that happened between India and Pakistan be avoided if the leadership had not gone down a sectarian or religious or nationalistic route? And then one of the stories that comes across in it is how his wife died, because he was somebody who was a very Western person, a barrister trained in London, but then rejected the Western world and rejected Western medicine and refused to allow his wife to have antibiotics. And she died of a pneumonia. So, you know, there's so many of these figures. Churchill's another one that are much more complex. And history has kind of turned them into heroes. And
isn't that why
we're only kind of half heroes, really?
And there was also some peculiar things with him, that he wanted to sleep with very young people to test himself.
To prove his, or to test his chastity, which would now be considered something quite different.
I think that's why we say we don't put up statues to people till they're dead a really long time, because only in the fullness of time does I suppose judgment get passed on people. You have a really interesting kind of honourable mention.
Yeah, so two, actually. I've done the fiction and non-fiction again. So non-fiction is United Ireland For and Against. That's written by Fintan O'Toole and Sam McBride. Essentially four essays. But what's really interesting about it, is they're both required to argue the case for and against. So it's not just for from Vinton and against from Sam McBride. They're each required to make the case for and against in their separate essays. And I think that's a really good intellectual discipline. I've tried to do it myself a few times. You actually understand the other person's argument
better. We were always taught that when we were debating.
Yeah, when you when you've actually argued the counterpoint, sometimes you even change your mind as a result. So it's a good read.
Did you change your mind? Read.
No, but there were things in I didn't think about though. So it's definitely, and as part of my job was to think about these things. So it's definitely a good read. Then on the fiction side, and again, pure escapism, but really love it, is the Aisling series by Ewan McLeish and Sarah Breen. And most people know this. It sold like 500,000 copies already or something. But it's very much about Aisling, sort of country girl next door who comes to Dublin, follows her.
She's an Irish every woman, kind of, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, and not even just every woman. Like, you know, even as a man, I can very much identify
just wee Aisling
with some of her experiences. And, you know, you kind of start.
I should say, actually, it's Misha Aisling. Yeah. I shouldn't say just wee.
But, you know, you start a bit laughing at her, and then you're sort of laughing with her because you identify with her as it goes on. Now, the second book is a bit more serious and explores some more serious themes. But I've only read 2 of the 5. So. Hopefully now on my holly bops this August.
Do you know what? I am
number 3.
I am a great lover on holiday. I read differently on holidays to any other time insofar as I don't want to be challenged particularly. I want to have something that I can lie by a pool and have a drink in my hand and read, and a bit like the Aisling, but it's although quintessentially British, I keep reading Jilly Cooper on holidays days, and I find them just great fun. But there's also another book we should talk about, Your Own.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about it.
So my memoir, Speaking My Mind, it is now available in paperback. So cheapest ships, costs roughly the same as a cocktail. So you should be able to buy it either. Actually isn't in a lot of shops when I've dropped by, but it is available in most shops and then certainly online. And also, the paperback is a bit updated on the hardback, so that's all in audio as well.
You're young, Leo, to have written a memoir. Now, that's not withstanding the fact that you've done a huge amount, more than most people have at your age. But you are young. Were you tempted at all to wait and let some time pass, or do you think there will be a second memoir update?
To be honest, the reason why I did it not long after leaving office. Well, first of all, I had the time.
Yeah,
there's a year gap during which you can't do commercial work and advisory work and so on. So I had a bit of time to do it. And secondly, it was very much fresh in my memory. As actually somebody who works in RTE said to me that it was a good idea to write it because that way you're writing the first draft of that period in history. And while people will not agree with it, they'll have other takes on things, they will write other books, they at least have to have regard to what you said. And it was an interesting process. I had to learn how to write in a totally different way. Got a lot of help. But, you know, I had spent a life writing prescriptions and medical charts and memos and letters.
Do you have a legible writing?
I do have legible writing, yeah. But I did this straight into the laptop. But had to learn how to write dialogue, for example, which is a very different skill. And then how to describe the room you're in, what you see, what you hear, what you smell. It's just not the way you write in medicine or politics. So it was kind of nice to learn a new skill too. So there might well be another book down the line, but nothing at the moment.
Do you think there will be some surprises in this book for people?
I hope so. Like, a lot of it's obviously been out there already, but I know people who read it found it very accessible, and they say they got a real insight into what I was thinking, why things happened the way they did, why they didn't.
And of course, you were Taoiseach during incredibly... Yeah.
And that's my whole career, from growing up through to Enda Kenny's government, through to my own. So everything from the global financial crash and water charges and austerity through to Brexit, COVID.
Yeah, Ukraine, I mean, COVID...
Referendums, you name it.
I still remember sitting in my living room and seeing you come down the steps in Washington to tell us, you know, our greatest generations weren't behind us, to tell us that, you know, we have to dig in. And, you know, we were already in lockdown for, I think, at that point, about 5 days. But, you know, those kind of speeches, they are a bit like we shall fight them on the beaches. You know, they're those speeches that people will probably remember where they were and where they heard them at the time for a generation.
Yeah, and I can tell in the book, I'll tell you the whole story of that speech and how it was kind of really thrown together that night. There's not very many moments in a real political career that feel like The West Wing, but that was definitely one of those moments, being really bundled out of a dinner through the kitchens to be
told that. It must have been decisions kind of surreal. I mean, it's to be the Taoiseach, I'm sure you'd gotten used to it. I'm sure you knew, you know, what, how to behave and what was expected of you. But we were in such uncharted waters. I mean, austerity and the crash was one thing, but I remember the dystopian fear that occurred when COVID hit. I had a very surreal moment myself during your speech. My phone rang during your speech, and I actually thought, who the hell is ringing me now? Because I'm glued to the telly. And I answered the phone, and it was the HSE to tell me I had COVID.
Oh, right. Yeah.
In the middle of your speech. And we didn't know what it meant to have COVID at that stage. This was the first wave.
Projections at the time, which turned out to be excessively pessimistic, but the projections at the time, you know, were for about 20,000 deaths in a best case scenario or something like that. I might have those numbers wrong. Yeah, so if you want to relive all that, there's a lot more in the book than that, of course.
I certainly do.
Now, one of the criticisms is that I don't go into enough kind of detail around policy and politics and so on. But I think somebody else will write this book. You know, I want this to be for everyone. And
I think that might have made it less
25,000 words.
Less accessible.
Because that's all Penguin said I could do. So there's also a lot not in there. So I think somebody else will probably write a much longer, more academic book.
Oh, I'm sure.
But this is one for everyone.
And maybe lastly, just never mind books. What next for Leo Varadkar? You are still a young man. You have done an enormous amount, but well, I'm of an age now where I refer to middle-aged people as young men. But the future?
Yeah, so look, doing lots of things at the moment. I have some academic appointments, mainly in the States. So we'll be back. Back
Harvard.
Up to Harvard in September, middle of September, October. And do a bit of consulting with Penta Group all over the world, but mainly here in Dublin. Write a column in the Sunday Times from time to time. I wrote a book, as you know, and then also I'm involved in some kind of charities and think tanks on the boards there. So it's a nice mix of things. I'm not on the lookout or canvassing for any big boy jobs at the moment. I'm not sure I'm ready for that.
You're not heading off like Pascal to the World Bank or some such?
No, I delightedly got that post. No better man, but that wouldn't be me, or certainly not at the moment. You know, I'm liking the idea of freedom and doing a mix of different things and not being responsible for anyone or accountable to anyone, which is not something I felt really since I was probably a medical student, like that long ago.
Last question for you. I remember when you first kind of emerged onto the political scene, and people used to say what they liked about you is that you did speak your mind and that you had the unusual habit as a politician of answering questions when you were asked them. I thought as you went on over your career, and I think it probably would make sense that you became a little more circumspect at times, and you know, particularly maybe when you were in the role of Taoiseach or Taoiseach. It has struck me since you have left politics that you've reverted more to sort of speaking your mind, and you're a bit freer. Do you feel
that? Yeah. And you know, it's one of the things that one of the reasons why I kind of fell out of love of politics was that change that I had to adapt to. And it's easy to speak your mind when you're speaking for yourself. When you're a leader of a political party that's in a coalition and you're speaking for a country, you really aren't speaking for yourself a lot of the time anymore. And you have to modulate and change and adapt to what you're going to say. And you also have to think about how that's going to sound in a few hours' time when somebody else has asked what they think of what you said, and also how people, and this happens, people
we've
twist and manipulate what you said. So
lived
I don't really care about that anymore.
Some of the most vicious periods, I think, imaginable on social media. So no matter what you said, sometimes you could be cast in a bad light.
Yeah. Oh, and sometimes you didn't say it at all. It's just what somebody decided you said.
Yeah. Anyway, look, the very best of luck with it, whatever the future holds. And thank you for putting your books on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf. That is Leo Varadkar.
Thank you.
The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman. With Kia. Weekdays at 4 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.